Suddenly, the unexpected happened. Approaching from the north end of Las Pozas was a man himself, SS Obersturmbannführer Walter Rau, the alleged murderer of 250,000 human beings. There at the gate, he came face to face with an unwelcome visitor carrying a hidden radio microphone.
You live in Santiago, don't you?
Eh?
You live here in Santiago?
Yes.
Yes. But you are fighting your case?
No.
Because you have
my case is finished. Completely finished. I am not guilty. I ought to say only the verity.
Only the whole truth.
Yeah, not more.
Willkommen bei Rätsel der Wissenschaft, dem Standard-Podcast über die großen Fragen der Menschheit. Ich bin Tanja Traxler.
Und ich bin Klaus Taschwer.
Wir beschäftigen uns jeden zweiten Mittwoch mit den ganz großen und ganz kleinen Mysterien in unserem Universum. Heute blicken wir auf einen besonders grausamen Nazitäter zurück, den Deutschen Walter Rauf. Das war einer jener SS-Verbrecher, die nach 1945 den zweiten Teil ihres mörderischen Lebens weitgehend unbehelligt in Südamerika verbrachten. Rund um dieses zweite Leben gab es bis vor kurzem aber eine große offene Frage. Lebte Rauf in Chile einfach ungestört als Privatmann sein Leben bis zu seinem Tod, das war im Jahr 1984, weiter? Oder setzte er unter dem rechten Diktator General Augusto Pinochet seine Verbrechen fort?
Das Tondokument, das ihr zu Beginn hören konntet, ist deshalb besonders, weil es das einzige mit Walter Raus Stimme ist. Es stammt aus dem Film The Hunter and the Hunted aus dem Jahr 1981. Für diesen Film begab sich ein kleines australisches Team nach Südamerika, um dort Nazi-Kriegsverbrecher aufzuspüren. Der vielleicht schlimmste, der vor die Kamera geriet, war Walter Rauf. Der war in seinem ersten Leben unter anderem SS-Standartenführer und der Organisator der sogenannten Gaswagenmorde, denen mehr als 300.000 Menschen zum Opfer fielen. Nach dem Krieg konnte Rauf 1948 in Italien aus alliierter Haft fliehen. Der in Rom tätige österreichische Bischof Alois Hudal verhalf ihm zunächst zur Flucht nach Syrien. Ein Jahr später floh er wieder über Rom nach Ecuador. 1958 übersiedelte er nach Chile, wo er 1979 oder 1980 für die Filmdokumentation aufgespürt wurde. Im Tondokument sagte er in schlechtem Englisch: Ich muss den Juristen anrufen. Mein Fall ist abgeschlossen. Ich bin nicht schuldig. Ich will nur die Wahrheit sagen.
Die Wahrheit ist aber, dass Rauf maßgeblich zum Holocaust beigetragen hat und zu den besonders grausamen Massenmördern des NS-Regimes zählte. Das ist zeithistorisch auch nie in Zweifel gestanden. Ein unabgeschlossener Fall und ein Rätsel der Zeitgeschichte-Forschung war aber bis vor kurzem sein zweites Leben in Chile. Bald nach dem blutigen Putsch von General Augusto Pinochet im September 1973 kamen Gerüchte auf, dass Rauf für den berüchtigten chilenischen Geheimdienst DINA tätig gewesen sei und sich an der Folterung, Ermordung und am Verschwinden von vielen oppositionellen Linken beteiligt habe.
Konkrete Beweise fehlten aber lange. Der renommierte britische Autor, Anwalt und Völkerrechtsprofessor Philip Sands hat sie in achtjähriger Recherche gefunden, unter anderem mit Hilfe des eingangs eingespielten Tondokuments. Über diese spannende Spurensuche, die seit kurzem als Buch vorliegt, sprachen wir in Kooperation mit einem Team der Zeitgeschichte-Professorin Kerstin von Lingen mit dem Autor.
Aber wie kam Philip Sands, der mit Rückkehr nach Lemberg und Die Rattenlinie zwei internationale Bestseller über die NS-Täter Hans Frank und den Österreicher Otto Wächter vorlegte, überhaupt auf den Fall Walter Rauf?
I came across Walter Rauf in a sense by accident. As you know, the basis for much of what I wrote in Die Rattenlinie was a remarkable archive, which is now publicly available on the website of the US Holocaust Memorial Museum, of private correspondence, documents, photographs, tape recordings relating to Otto and Charlotte Wächter, who are the main subjects of the Ratline. Buried amongst those thousands and thousands of pages, I came across a three-page typewritten letter sent to Otto Wächter while he was on the run in Italy. The author of the letter, who wrote from Damascus, Syria, advised him not to come to Syria, but instead to make his way to South America. And I was interested in the name of the person who wrote the letter, Walter Rauf. As I saw it, I thought I didn't know this name, and so I Googled it and informed myself, as you've described, what he had done in the past in terms of the gas wagons, in terms of his role as the head of the Gestapo in Milan, in terms of his role in Tunisia. Later, I came to understand that I did know this name, actually, because it features in a remarkable British travel book by the English writer Bruce Chatwin in Patagonia, chapter 96. There is a man in Punta Arenas, that's Walter Rauf. And in Roberto Bolaño's two novels, Nights in Chile and Nazi Literature in the Americas. But I'd forgotten that. So I started doing a bit of research and discovered that Rauf ended up in Chile. He moved there in 1958, and he lived in the southernmost town in the whole world, Punta Arenas, where he was the manager of a king crab cannery. That immediately got me thinking, could it be that there's a link between Augusto Pinochet, in whose proceedings in London I'd been involved in 1998, and Walter Rauf? And the reason that I asked that question was, if the answer was affirmative, yes, there is a link, there would be a direct and unbroken line from the work I did on East West Street about Hans Frank, through to the book on the Ratline, Otto Wächter, through to his comrade, Walter Rauf, in 38 Londres Street, and through to my desk in October 1998, when I had to deal with the crimes of the Pinochet regime. And I was rather intrigued by that possibility.
Endergebnis der aufwendigen Spurensuche in Chile, für die Sands weder Kosten noch Mühen scheute, ist sein jüngstes 600-seitiges Buch, Die Verschwundenen von Londres 38. Londres ist Spanisch für London, was einerseits auf Pinochets Hausarrest in London von 1998 bis 2000 und seine Auslieferung nach Chile hinweist. Londres 38 ist aber vor allem jene Adresse in Santiago de Chile, wo der chilenische Geheimdienst ein Folterzentrum eingerichtet hat und wo schwerste Misshandlungen politischer Gefangener begangen wurden.
Wie schon bei den Recherchen seiner früheren beiden Bücher stieß Sands auf einige schier unglaubliche und völlig unbekannte Geschichten. Eine davon betrifft den kürzlich verstorbenen Journalisten Gerd Heidemann, der 1983 für den Ankauf und Publikation der gefälschten Hitler-Tagebücher durch das Magazin Stern berühmt wurde. Heidemann begab sich 1979 auf eine Südamerika-Reise. Das tat er als Begleiter des früheren SS-Generals Karl Wolf, der war der Vorgesetzte von Rauf früher mal. Fast 35 Jahre später kommt es zu einem Wiedersehen der beiden in Santiago de Chile. Allein dieses Treffen, sein Hintergrund und die Rolle von Heidemann geben den Stoff für einen eigenen Film her. Hier ist die Kurzfassung von Philip Sands.
Out of the blue, Walter Rauf one day receives a phone call from his son saying a gentleman has called up by telephone, Herr Wolf, and is in Santiago and would like to come and see him. And so the reaction of Rauf is just joyous because he hasn't seen his boss and comrade and colleague for 35 years, and he's thrilled. And they then spend 4 days together. Now, Wolf is accompanied by a man who's presented as a writer, who is only referred to in many of the documents as G. And the writer describes to Rauf that he's there to assist Wolf in the writing of his memoirs. And they are making a journey across all of South America to meet old comrades, Klaus Barbie, they're going to look for Bormann, they're going to look for Mengele. I mean, you literally couldn't invent it. And I approached Heidemann and he declined to give me access to his records, but I've subsequently got access to the records, which are now publicly available and are in the archives at Stanford University. I think I was the first person to see them. But even more remarkably, with the assistance of colleagues at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, I came across a document at Yad Vashem, which was a single copy of an account by Mossad of historical efforts to capture Nazis in the 70s and 80s. The document was in Hebrew, so I had to get a PhD student to translate the whole thing, 50 pages, and I was stunned by what I read, because what I read in this document, an official Mossad document, so this is not rumors, this is every detail you could imagine, is that the trip to Santiago by Wolf and G was what we might call in English a reconnaissance effort. As soon as the trip was over and Heidemann returned to Hamburg, he prepared a report. And he sent the report to Mossad. It included, and I've seen them, photographs and details of Ralph's house in Santiago, where he had moved after he retired, and proceeded to contain information on the points of strength and weakness of the difficulties of mounting an assassination attempt on Ralph. And then the documents continue to describe the efforts 6 months later by Mossad to assassinate Walter Rauf on the basis of the report produced by G. I tracked down and spoke to the person, former Mossad agent, who had prepared this document. And at a certain point, I said to him, "Are you willing to tell me who G is?" He said, "No, that's a state secret." And I said, "I think I know who G is." And he sort of chuckled. I recorded the conversation. And I said, he said, "Really? Who do you think it is?" And I said, "He's a journalist for Stern magazine, the man who did the Hitler diaries." And the guy at the end of the phone just laughed. This was on the telephone interview. And I said, "It was Gerd Heidemann, wasn't it?" And he said, "Ha, ha, ha, what a pig that man was." And it turns out that Gerd Heidemann, Stern journalist, notorious for many things, including the production of the Hitler diaries, which was a big scandal in Britain, he went to prison for it, was a, I don't know whether you would call it an informant or an agent, but he was in the service of Mossad.
Zurück zu Rauf. Sein Deckname war der Schakal. Und die große Frage bleibt, war er tatsächlich an zentraler Stelle in die Verbrechen des chilenischen Geheimdienstes involviert? Nach und nach gelingt es Sainz bei seinen Recherchen, konkrete Beweise zu finden, die an Grausamkeit schwer zu übertreffen sind. Rauf hat nicht nur an der Adresse Londres 38 seine SS-geschulten Methoden zur Anwendung gebracht. Wie schon in der NS-Zeit spielten kleine LKWs eine wichtige Rolle bei der Beseitigung der Opfer und deren Leichen wurden in Chile nach Anweisungen von Rauf in der chilenischen Kleinstadt San Antonio von einer Fabrik für Fischmehl zu Hühnerfutter verarbeitet.
Ja, angesichts dieser Schilderungen bleibt einem wirklich die Sprache weg. Äußerst interessant im Fall Rauf ist aber auch, dass lange bevor Sands und andere den Nazi in Chile zum Thema gemacht haben, nicht nur der eingangs erwähnte Bruce Chatwin und zum Teil auch zu ähnlichen Ergebnissen kamen, ohne dafür Evidenz zu haben.
So findet sich beim chilenischen Dichter Pablo Neruda eine prophetische Bemerkung zu Rauf, die bereits aus dem Jahr 1965 stammt. Und auch der chilenische Schriftsteller Roberto Bolaño lässt ihn auf eine Art und Weise vorkommen, die viel von dem vorwegnimmt, was Sainz 20 Jahre später herausgefunden hat. Als preisgekrönter Sachbuchautor und noch mehr als Jurist musste er allerdings konkrete und harte Fakten liefern. Und das gelang ihm unter anderem mit der zu Beginn eingespielten Tonaufnahme Raufs.
You know, we lawyers are not good for much, but we are terrified in court of being asked, "What's your evidence for that, Mr. Sands?" And we can't rely on rumors. We're dead if we rely on rumors. We need either documents or testamentary evidence. We have to have one or the other. But this relationship between fact and fiction reminds me of another remarkable moment. You know, many people will have seen the film or the play by Ariel Dorfman called Death and the Maiden, where there's a very famous scene in which the main protagonist, a woman who has been viciously tortured and raped and mistreated, is unable to recognize the identity visually of her torturer. But by a series of curious coincidences in this fictionalized account, the torturer turns up in her home and engages with her husband, and she's in the room next door and she recognizes the voice. So I came to know and be introduced to the director of a part of the Pesquera Arauca, which had the fleet of refrigerated vans, which had operated the fishmeal plant. And he was arrested on the day of the coup, September 11, 1973, and the army takes over the fish plant. I mean, lots of people told me that. Like, why would the army take over a fishery? It's really strange. And they didn't, everyone else had no answer to that. But Anatolia Zarate is then carted off to San Antonio, which is just a few kilometers away, and tortured over 6 months in a facility called Tejas Verdes. And he doesn't recognize any of his torturers because he says, whenever I was tortured, I had a black hood or I had a hood over my head. But I heard voices. And I said, were there any foreign voices? And he said, yes, I had Portuguese and I had one German voice. I said, one German voice. He said, yes, very distinctive. And I said, do you think you'd recognize that voice again? He said, absolutely. It was a very guttural smoker's voice. And I said, I've got a recording of a voice. May I play it to you? Perhaps you don't want to listen to it. And he thought about it and said, yeah, no, I'm willing to listen to it. And so I got the recording and it's actually a video, which is incredible. It's the only known video, none of you have probably seen it, of Walter Rauf, where he's accosted in 1979, 1980, by an Australian journalist. We can play it, actually, if you want. And we put the video on. It was on my laptop. I was with my assistant, Montserrat. It's very important, I found, that when you do these interviews, you're not alone. You need a reality check from someone else. She's doing her PhD at UCL. She's very incredibly reliable. And because she has complete mastery of the Spanish language, which I don't have, she picks up tiny nuances. So we put on this video, and he watches it, and then Rauf comes on. He's not talking at this point. And then he speaks. And at the moment he spoke, the man's body froze. It was incredible. He grasped his hands like this and did not let go for many minutes. He went silent. He started sweating profusely. And he said, yes. And he said, that's the voice. That's the voice. And it was Walter Rauf. And so these moments, you know, as a litigator, you're testing constantly. Is this credible? Is this true? What are the weaknesses? If there was a cross-examination by the other side, what would they say? That's the mindset, not just of a historian, but a lawyer who has to prove their case in court. And I have no doubt.
Ja, Schilderungen wie diese zeigen, wie Sands in seiner Recherche wirklich detektivisch vorgegangen ist, um Evidenzen zu sammeln zu den offenen Fragen zu Walter Rauf. Seit das Buch im Frühjahr in Chile erschienen ist, wurden etliche Fälle von bisher nicht verurteilten Tätern neu aufgerollt. In der Folge der Präsentation des Buchs, in dem Sands freilich nicht alle Gerüchte um Rauf bestätigen konnte, tauchten aber auch neue Fakten auf. So konnte er keine harte Evidenz für das Gerücht finden, dass Rauf für Pinochet den Bau eines Konzentrationslagers in Patagonien koordiniert habe, das verdächtig nach einem Nazi-KZ aussah. Nach seiner Präsentation der spanischen Übersetzung des Buchs vor ein paar Wochen in Chile in unmittelbarer Nähe des Konzentrationslagers hat sich freilich auch dafür ein sehr konkreter Hinweis gefunden.
You write these books and they get out there and remarkable things emerge. But you'll have known that one of the issues that emerged that I could not find evidence on was in relation to all the allegations that Walter Rauf constructed the Nazi-looking Auschwitz-style concentration camp on Dawson Island. So many rumors So many of the people who were detained there said to me, no, we all heard it was Walter Rauf who designed it, who built it, who was involved. Did you see him? Are there any documents? I found nothing. It was just rumors. 3 weeks ago, I'm in Porvenir, the small town where Rauf lived, and we did an event at the museum, and the population's only 2,000, and like 100 people came to the event, so it was a significant group came. The director of the museum, wonderful lady, after the event, said, I had an interesting dinner with my grandmother last night. Of course, like everyone else, she remembered Rauf, everyone remembered Rauf. And she said, my grandmother said to me, but I didn't only remember him from the street or from the supermarket or from the pesquera. I worked for him. On 5 occasions, I cooked him a special meal. He had important visitors. I didn't know who they were, and he needed someone to prepare a good meal in the evenings. And this happened 5 times in the 1970s, in the mid-1970s. And after the meal was over, all the gentlemen would leave with Rauf, and they all went to Dawson Island. And so we're now re-interviewing that lady. And I think that what you learn is that in any community, you have it in Austria, you have it in Britain, any community where bad things have happened, there's silence. And there's a lot more to come out, but that is the kind of thing that happens when you write these books. More stories, more evidence emerges. I mean, I've got zero doubt that Rauf is involved. Just now that I've begun to put all the things together, it's, to me, absolutely crystal clear.
Eine Langfassung dieses wirklich spannenden Gesprächs mit Philipp Sainz findet ihr bei Transit, dem Podcast zur Migrationsgeschichte, produziert von Studierenden der Zeitgeschichte der Universität Wien. Wer an dem Thema noch tiefer und weiter interessiert ist, empfehlen wir nicht nur das Buch Die Verschwundenen von Londres 38, sondern auch die beiden ersten Bände der Trilogie von Philipp Sainz über Naziverbrecher, Recht und Gerechtigkeit, nämlich Rückkehr nach Lemberg und Die Rattenlinie.
Für heute sagen wir Danke fürs Zuhören. Wir verabschieden uns mit dieser wirklich atemberaubenden Geschichte über Walter Rauf in die Sommerpause. Vielleicht ein etwas schweres Thema, um uns in den Sommer zu verabschieden, aber es ist ja immerhin Gedenkjahr. Wir sind dann Anfang Oktober wieder zurück mit Rätsel der Wissenschaft und wir freuen uns natürlich, wenn ihr dann wieder dabei seid. Ich bin Tanja Traxler.
Und ich bin Klaus Taschwer.
Diese Folge wurde von Christoph Neuwirth produziert. Schönen Sommer euch und bis zum nächsten Mal.
Bis bald.
What I was able to establish was that Rauf resumed his career in 1941 and 42. It was disappearing people through the use of gas fans. In 1974 and 1975, it was disappearing people through the use of refrigerated vans. And this is particularly shocking because I think it underscores why, however we go about doing justice, the do-nothing option is not an option. People have a propensity to resume their previous tasks.